We're so pleased to welcome you to our last day at Sunstone. Thank you for attending the opening session 311 titled Naturalistic Explanations for the Origin of the Book of Mormon 1829 to 2018. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build the community that allows many people to express their faith. Our recent tagline is There is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. What this means is we all get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things that you agree with, things that will inspire you, and things that help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways. As you go through the conference and encounter ideas all over the spectrum of belief, we invite you to employ empathy as your standard of engagement. We are so very pleased you have decided to join us at this conference. We hope you enjoy this session and the sessions to come. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk at the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom, hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from the programs, this presentation description is as follows. Even before it was published, alternate stories were issued to compete with Joseph Smith's explanation of the Book of Mormon's origin. Five will be introduced and tracked chronologically. 1. The original manuscript of the Book of Mormon was written by Solomon Spaulding. 2. Collaborators helped Joseph Smith create the text. 3. Joseph Smith's mental illness enhanced his writing ability. 4. Automatic writing. Joseph functioned as a spirit medium while dictating the Book of Mormon. And 5. Joseph Smith, perhaps the help from his environment, with help from his environment, the Bible and other books, was capable of producing the Book of Mormon from his own intellect. Brian C. Hills is the author of Setting the Record Straight, Mormon Fundamentalism, and also Modern Polygamy and Mormon Fundamentalism, The Generations After the Manifesto, which received the Best Book of 2007 award from the John Whitmer Historical Association. And now for our presentation. Thank you.
I appreciate Amy's introduction. And I want you to know I have presented at Sunstone to even smaller groups than this over the years. First time I presented was 1991. And so it goes way back. And I appreciate Lindsay and the Sunstone Program Committee for accepting my proposal. We're going to talk today about the origin of the Book of Mormon. Oh, and let me also say, there's some really good sessions right now. I kind of wish I were in Todd Compton's, to be honest with you, but I don't want anybody to get up and leave. But thank you. Thank you for attending, and I'm looking forward to good questions during the Q&A afterwards. And can everybody hear me okay? That mic really seems to pick up well, so that's nice. If we look at the Book of Mormon, we see that it's not a simple book. It's long. There's lots of words and sentences. It's got a lot of different people and groups. There's chiasms and things of this nature. And if we put it into an algorithm to try to identify what age group it is written for, we would discover that it's probably, by most of these algorithms, written to an eighth grade reading level. And some of them put it higher. Some of them, there's one that puts it down to the sixth grade. You can see the Lexile score in the span, but it isn't a book that you would call a nursery rhyme or something for a grade school student. If you have more interest in this, I have this article that gives all of the data on those, on the breakdown of the reading level. It's called Curiously Unique. Joseph Smith is author of the Book of Mormon. And you're welcome to go there. Now, the big question that we're going to be talking about today is about the Book of Mormon. Where did all the words come from? That's what the question we're trying to answer. Joseph Smith said it was a supernatural origin. But as soon as he said this, people who reject the supernatural, either for him specifically or for, you'll have to forgive me, I did get up and exercise this morning. that people who reject either the supernatural for him or the supernatural in general are going to say, no, no, the words came from a natural origin. And this has been going on for a very long time. In fact, immediately after the book is published, there are sources that are saying, no, Joseph is the author of this. He just made it up. And then you fast forward to recent decades, and there's been just dozens of books written that address this either directly or tangentially, saying, no, the book came from natural origins, and the supernatural was not involved. And I appreciate Dan Vogel. I put your book right up there, Dan, so because I think he champions this idea. And I don't mean to embarrass you. Sorry. Dan's a friend of mine, and we appreciate our discussions. But what I've done ever since I stopped looking at polygamy, and this is about 4 years ago, is that I put together a database of over 170 secular explanations. And I didn't know this would be so noisy. Sorry about that. It just comes in the program. But it's a database where I just look at all the secular explanations, and then I tried to isolate the ones that are the most popular. And there are actually five that pop out, and there's some that are less common. But the five are the Spaulding theory, and Amy actually read these off: collaboration, mental illness, automatic writing, and Joseph's intellect. And what's interesting is if we chart these over time, we find if you look at this chart, just notice column number five is Joseph Smith's intellect. When Joseph Smith publishes the book, people are saying the book is dumb, Joseph is dumb. See, they go together. But then notice over on the far left, the Solomon Spaulding theory is introduced in 1834. It dominates most of the explanations until about 1884 when it stops. And then we see this smattering of ideas that is promoted by different authors. And then towards the end, we see the Joseph Smith intellect, the far right column, is again dominating the landscape of what people are saying. And if we graph it this way, again, we see the dark purple is Joseph Smith's intellect. It's at the beginning. It's at the end. The pink is the Solomon Spaulding theory coming in there. So we're just going to talk about these five theories and why none of them have completely dominated the landscape historically. Now, the Spaulding theory began in 1812 when Solomon Spaulding wrote a manuscript called Manuscript Story. And he shares this with his neighbors. And they like it. And then Spaulding dies in 1816. And the theory is that this manuscript went to Sidney Rigdon. And Rigdon added some religious elements to it, slipped the copy to Joseph Smith, who then got it into the translation process. And then the Book of Mormon is published. And people start reading the Book of Mormon. And some of those people are those neighbors who remember the manuscript story that Spaulding wrote. And they're saying, hey, this Book of Mormon is just like that manuscript thing that Solomon Spaulding wrote. And that theory was published in 1834 and Mormonism unveiled. And it predominated, as we saw, for 50 years. But then in 1884, they find the manuscript, and people kind of start to lose interest in this theory. There are some people today who continue to promote the Spaulding theory. And what they say is that Manuscript Story was only one of two manuscripts that Spaulding wrote. He wrote another one called Manuscript Found. And that was the one that was read to the neighbors, and it was very similar to the Book of Mormon, and in fact was the original manuscript for the Book of Mormon. So this hasn't completely died out. Uncle Dale's Vault, how many of you have used that online? Anybody? He, I think, is a proponent of this, or at least he has been. Now, the reasons why the Spaulding theory hasn't really caught on is that at 50,840 words, it's much less than the Book of Mormon, which was almost 270,000. The overall writing style and composition are vastly different. There's no identical or similar names of people and places. There's no documentation that Sidney Rigdon met Spaulding or knew of the story. I mean, it's all based on speculation. Geographically, the circumstantial evidence supports that Rigdon was unfamiliar with the Book of Mormon. In fact, it was according to him, the reason he converted. And then trying to get a pre-existing manuscript into the translation process is difficult because you've got unbelievers like Reuben Hale, who's serving as a scribe for a time, who wouldn't have been a co-conspirator on anything. And then, of course, you've got Martin Harris and David Whitmer and others describing the same process. So that's a problem. Moving on now to the second popular theory, and that is collaborators. The most common of the candidates would be Oliver Cowdery, and this has been reemphasized by Robert D. Anderson in his book, and also more recently Richard Van Wagner's book, talk about how they colluded together and were able to create the manuscript. Sidney Rigdon is also mentioned, independent of the Spalding theory, because he really was the smartest one of the bunch and had oratory abilities, and people imagine he would have to have been involved. And there are some stories about him being with Joseph Smith in 1827 that are kind of intriguing. They're not credible, but they're out there. So I just introduced this one. This is kind of fun. The Sheets put together a very big book. It's like 500 pages about how Joseph Smith Sr. was the primary mover. He wrote it, and then Joseph Jr. was the front man. And they promote this very aggressively in their book. Now, the reasons that the collaborator theory is not more widely accepted, quite honestly, the supportive arguments are primarily speculative. There's just no credible corroborative historical documentation for really any of these. And then you got to ask the question, why would anyone, especially someone like Sidney Rigdon, put in all of the work to create this manuscript but never later demand some credit for it? And then we have the same issue: if somebody collaborated, how did that get into the translation process, which is pretty well documented in the historical record? Mental illness. And it's a retrospective diagnosis. Nobody in Joseph Smith's day said, Joseph, you have mental illness. But then you wouldn't have expected them to do that. They didn't have the diagnostic tools to do that. So that really may not be very helpful. But in 1903, Woodbridge Riley said Joseph had epilepsy. Bernard DeVoto in 1930 said he had a paranoid personality disorder. Harry Beardsley, dementia praecox. Kimball Young, a peripath. That's not even a medical diagnosis, but he talks all about it. Klaus Hansen said schizophrenia, but he kind of backed away from that, but he mentioned it. Larry Foster said bipolar disorder. And I talked to Larry at MHA. He's actually backed away from this, too. He's picked something else I'll introduce in a second. Bill Moraine, in his book, Sword of Laban, said Joseph was dissociated. And then Robert Anderson did narcissistic personality disorder. And that's what Larry Foster is saying. I bracketed it for reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. It's kind of different from the others. Now, the reasons why mental illness is not more accepted are that psychoanalyzing dead people is kind of an inexact science. Dr. Roy Grinker said this. He said, Freud started the fashion of analyzing writers as well as historical characters such as Shakespeare, Leonardo da Vinci, and even Moses. Many of his students have followed this pattern in writing, often brilliantly imaginative interpretations of the neuroses and psychoses of authors, playwrights, and artists, which are based on a minimum of evidence. Psychoanalytic theory carried to excess, or based on biased reports of life histories of authors, becomes ridiculous. A second reason is that narcissism could increase your confidence. And a manic bipolar phase could amplify a person's energy. If you've ever seen anybody in the manic phase of a bipolar, it's pretty impressive. But mental illness will always diminish your overall cognitive functions. You don't get mentally ill and suddenly become a great author or playwright. Otherwise, these mental hospitals would just be teeming with all kinds of incredible creative works from the people that are in them. It's just the opposite. The fourth one is automatic writing, and this is a very fun topic, and I would refer you to this article in Dialogue, Automatic Writing in the Book of Mormon, an update. It talks a lot about this in much greater detail than I can introduce here, but automatic writing is a term used to designate writing that is done without the writer being conscious of what he is writing. A person who writes automatically is usually in some altered state of consciousness. Now, before the psychologists got involved, there was spirit writing, trance writing, channeling, and this has been going on for hundreds of years. And it could be people even just talking, they could be writing, they could be using a planchette where you have a pen or a pencil just in a moving object. Ouija boards, very common, and many of us probably have maybe even had a chance to play with those. The characteristics of automatic writing are, first, there's just writing. There's no pre-writing. There's no rewriting. So what does that mean? Well, if you go onto any campus in the world and learn about creative writing, they will teach you pre-write, And that's where you get the outline, you gather research materials, and you get all kinds of references, quotes, and things of this nature. And then you write that first draft, and then you rewrite. You revise draft two, draft three, you content edit, you copy edit, and that's the rewriting phase. But with automatic writing, they just write. Just one line, and then that goes to be published. This is a very busy chart, and I apologize for that. What I've done, and this is reproduced in the dialogue article, is I've tried to gather every automatic writer who's made longer writings. There are people who produce poems every day. That I didn't include them here, but if they produce something that was pretty long, then I would include them. And for comparison purposes to Joseph Smith. Now, if we look at these people who are producing these automatic writings, one of the interesting observations is that their education doesn't always match the level of complexity of the books that they are writing or dictating. If you look at this column, you'll see there are PhDs and there are people who are very educated in that line, but there's also some who don't have very much education, but they're still producing some fairly complex works. Another one is that all of these writers attribute the source of their words to something outside of themselves. If you say, where do those words come from? They say, well, not from me, not from my mind. And if we look at the list again, we see they come from an inner voice, a transcendent, Jehovah, from Martians or from celestial beings, from someone called Seth or Astor or the Akashic Records, but something outside of the individual. And the most common comparison for the Book of Mormon and Joseph Smith is the Sari Tale. And this was written by Pearl Curran, but she claimed or reported that she got this from a woman who had died in the 1600s named Patience Worth. The Sari Tale has 264,000 words. It was published in 1917. The words came through a Ouija board that she later discarded. But before Curran had died, Patience Worth had communicated over 4 million words to Pearl Curran, which had been recorded. If we compare the Sari Tale to the Book of Mormon, we find some very interesting parallels. There's no denying these. The authors had minimal education. There was no pre-writing or rewriting, just dictation. The word counts are similar. The complexities are similar somewhat. Dictation session lengths were similar. They would start where the previous dictation left off without reviewing. There was no editing. It would go straight to the printer, and then they both used an instrument. One was the seer stone, and the other was the Ouija board. So there's drawing a parallel there is very easy to do. Now, the naturalistic explanation that is most common today for automatic writings is that we think with our conscious and preconscious mind, and there's a part of our minds that's called the unconscious, and the unconscious is full of memories and feelings and knowledge, and by automatic writing, we're able to get these out and into the open, and they can become a source of the writings themselves. And therapists will try to do this. They'll try to hypnotize their patients, and their patients will write automatically, and then they take that information and try to help their mental health. It's not real popular, but it is used. Recently, Anne Taze has reemphasized this idea of automatic writing in her book, Revelatory Events. And what she said was Joseph would see the seer stone, and it would trigger this formal hypnotic induction, this imaginative storytelling mode, a subjective experience of an altered state, a visual modality, a highly focused awareness, a translating mode. But he would be transformed. And she uses kind of this funny language. She's not a psychologist. She's a theologian. But definitely the seer stone is triggering a transition in Joseph's mental state. And from that transition, Joseph then could automate and effortlessly dictate the entire Book of Mormon. That's the theory. Now, the reasons why automatic writing is not more widely accepted is that hypnosis does not transform a person into someone with greater creativity, memory, or cognitive function. And what often will happen is that people will have someone in a trance and they'll remember something from when they were 5 years old. And then the proponents of automatic writing are saying, see, if you can remember something from when you were 5 years old, then Joseph Smith could have systematized all the memory needed to create the Book of Mormon. It's just, there's kind of a leap there, but that's some of the discussion. John F. Kilstrom, who is a cognitive social psychologist, explains hypnosis appears to be incapable of enhancing memory, but hypnotic procedures can impair memory. This is the general thing, and I've got dozens of these quotes. I've just given you representative examples here. John A. Barge, Ezekiel Mosey of Yale, they said, although concept activation and primitive associative learning could occur unconsciously, anything complex requiring flexible responding, integration of stimuli, or higher mental processes could not. And then Stephen J. Lynn, Harry Civic, hypnosis does not appear to bolster creativity relative to non-hypnotic conditions. Psychiatrist Robert D. Anderson, he actually is a proponent of our next theory we're going to talk about, but he was responding to Bill Moraine's book saying that Joseph would dissociate, and we don't have to get into the psychology of this, but it's another movement from your conscious state into some other state of the mind. But he said if Smith experienced dissociative states while creating the Book of Mormon, they were, in my opinion, limited in degree. Dissociative states require amnesia, significant distress, impairment in functioning, and or a disruption in the integrative function of consciousness, memory, and identity. He said, but the Book of Mormon contains integrated, careful calculations of fact and date, creating a complex history instead of a disorganized mess. This result suggests either full or nearly full personality function at the time of dictation. So he discounts this. Now, another reason why automatic writing theory has not really gained huge traction is that explaining one alleged supernatural activity by appealing to another supernatural activity really doesn't get you very far. What we need is a natural explanation that works for how one of them happened, and then it could be applied to both. Now, I just threw this slide in. What would Joseph Smith say about automatic writings? Well, he was kind of a revelatory elitist, if you will. If somebody had a revelation and it agreed with his, then it could be from God. Everything else came either from man or from false spirits. And I think that's how he would explain a lot of these automatic writings. The Joseph Smith intellect, as we saw earlier, is the most popular theory today. And the question is, according to the intellect theory, how did Joseph Smith produce all the words? And we remember there were a lot of words, a lot of sentences, a lot of things going on inside the text. And here's a criticism for those who promote the intellect theory, because I think to date they have treated Joseph Smith like a black box. What's a black box? A black box talks about inputs and outputs. It doesn't talk about what's going on inside the box. They just avoid the question. And so historically, treating Joseph like a black box, what happens is that people will focus on the input. He plagiarized the King James Bible. He borrowed from View of the Hebrews. He had parallelisms, or he borrowed from his environment. Or they will attack the output. Archaeology disproves it, or Indian DNA, or anachronisms, or the changes that Gerald Tanner found, or in linguistics. And sometimes there's this deception that if the people are talking about these things in yellow here, and they're acting like they're talking about how the Book of Mormon was produced, but they're really not. Okay, that part of what's going on inside of the box is just kind of set aside. And the question comes up, how do we open the box? Okay, and as we talk about this, we'll understand why it really hasn't been opened today, probably. But what do we have to do? I'll offer three suggestions. First, we can identify the cognitive skill sets that Joseph would have needed, and then show historically, as best we can, that Joseph possessed those skills. Well, how do you figure out what's going on in Joseph's mind as he's dictating the Book of Mormon? How can you do that? Well, it's not easy. What we do have is creative writing has been greatly studied historically. And there's lots of books and lots of articles that are written on how to do this. And there are models that have been made up on what is going on in the mind of a writer while they're writing a long book. And the most popular is this one by Linda Flowers and John Hayes. And what they did is they took a lot of writers and they said, we want you to record with a recorder what you're doing or thinking as at certain parts of the process of writing. And then they compiled all these and they created this model here. Again, this is creative writing, not creative dictation. But this is a starting point for trying to figure out what's going on in Joseph's mind as he's dictating all those words. If we look at the model, we find it starts with a rhetorical problem. Now, that's just a real academic way of saying this is his motivation. Why would Joseph or anybody write a very long book as they're doing? Now, the writer's long-term memory is very important, except in this model, the authors are allowing the long-term memory to include books and articles and notes and quotes and whatever external sources they want to put into that. It doesn't have to be something that they've memorized. And then this is the mental part of it, the writing processes. And you'll notice there's different boxes here. There's planning. This is where the words are originally generated. As you're trying to think of that next sentence, the words are starting to begin in this planning box. They're revised constantly mentally. They all come together and they're translated into the text produced so far. So these are kind of the steps, but there's an important other step, and that's this arrow here. Because once you've written it down, you can go ahead and revise it. You continue the revision. It creates cycles of writing and then revising in cycles over and over. Now, what if we were to take this writing model and try to convert it to apply possibly to Joseph Smith, who's dictating? What changes would we need to make? And this is a model that I have produced. And again, feel free to produce your own or critique it. But we have to make a few changes to it. The first is we bring everything into the mind, okay? The rhetorical problem, the writer's long-term memory. If Joseph is going to say something, it's going to have to be in his memory. Either he memorized it the night before or memorized it 3 years ago, but whatever he's going to produce while he's dictating has got to be stored in his memory because he didn't use outside sources, books, articles. This is kind of important because according to this theory, Joseph had been attending school for 7 years. He'd visited bookstores and libraries. He'd memorized the Bible. He'd been scrutinizing books like View of the Hebrews, The Last War, Napoleon's First Book. And he'd been going to lots of camp meetings and revivals. And if we read Mike Quinn, who's a friend of mine, but he would say Joseph was also reading magic books and all these things. He was a busy guy, according to this theory. Another change that we have to make here is the midterm and short-term memories are highly burdened because you're not working with paper. You're all just working from what's up here. And Flower and Hayes said that each word in the growing text determines and limits the choices of what can come next. In other words, you've kind of set a stage and you've got to stay within the constraints of what you've written before. And also the short-term memory is very important. Short term is that you've got to remember what you just barely said and how you said it, the syntax, the lexical choices. You've got to remember so that you can keep coherent sentences one right after another. The other change that we have to do here is notice this big arrow going up to the text produced so far. Once you speak it, you're done for the most part. There is no additional reviewing and evaluating. In other words, if we graph this, we see that with creative dictation, the draft one is the final draft. But with creative writing, of course, you had opportunities to have additional drafts. Now, if we apply this to Joseph Smith to see what kind of skills he may have had and whether he had what would be needed for him to have made the Book of Mormon, dictated it, according to this model, the motives for Joseph are still controversial. The nicest one is to call him a deceiver, but a pious deceiver, or somebody who's trying to do good, but you know he's not being on the up and up, but he's trying to do good. Most of the people in those secularists are saying Joseph wanted power, money, sex. These kind of things are what motivated him to do the Book of Mormon. The education, there's an article out saying he had 7 years. It's flawed. I think he probably had about a third grade education. Most of the people referring to him refer to him as being ignorant or uneducated. If we look at his experiences, he had limited travel to age 23. There is one recollection that says he participated in a local debate club occasionally, and that he also served as a passable Methodist exhorter. So there's a few things. If we look at his research, there's really not any any recollections that he was going to bookstores to write research or attending the libraries that were in the area. He did read dime novels. Creativity, we have Joseph's mother remembering that in 1823 he would give some recitals that were very creative. Beyond that, we don't really have any other creative references. His mid and short-term memories, it's hard to measure from the historical record, but we do know in 1835 when he was learning Hebrew, he was second only to Orson Pratt, who by far exceeded him. So the idea that Joseph had a photographic mind certainly wasn't manifest in that seven-week course that Joseph took. And then if we look just generally, he didn't have a reputation as a storyteller, improv performer, preacher, had no formal training in composition. They did not teach composition in the district schools in the 1820s in upstate New York. So he would have had limited experiences. To me, I'll just say I don't see a good connection there, but I'm biased. I'm a believer. And so I would love to have somebody who is a proponent of the intellect theory to take these ideas I've put here and make them work into a more plausible description, if that's how they feel good about explaining it. A second way to open the box would be to identify an intellectual who has dictated a long, complex book, like Joseph, but it's somebody who's closer to us, maybe even still alive, and we could talk to them or analyze them better than Joseph, who's been dead so long. Unfortunately, creative dictation is apparently very rare. Intellectuals pre-write and they rewrite. In every case, and I've looked at geniuses and read biographies and things, I can't find anybody dictating a long book. So we need examples. Again, an opportunity for proponents of this theory to look into. Can you find somebody else who's doing it? You've got the automatic writers, of course, but they wouldn't be the intellectuals. I threw this quote in. The editor, Stephen Hawking, took his job very seriously and made me rewrite the book. Each time I sent him a rewritten chapter, he sent it back with a long list of objections and questions he wanted me to clarify. At times, I thought the process would never end. And if you've ever published a 500-word book, and I've done three, you can totally relate to what Hawking was saying. A third way to open the black box is to design a study to duplicate Joseph Smith's efforts and then carry it out. But you know what? You don't have to do that, okay? Everybody in this hall can do what Joseph did, can replicate what he did with this right here, using the voice to text app in our phone. We do not need Oliver Cowdery. All you got to do is pull that up and send a series of text messages. And Royal Skousen tells us that they were at least 20 to 30 words each. Send them to somebody. It could be to yourself or someone, but have them just line these text messages up one right after another. And before you hit send, correct the grammar and spelling, because Joseph went back and did some of this in the second and third editions. But once you send it, then you're done with that text. And then you just do this over and over and over and over and over and over and over, over until you get about 10,000 times. Or until you come to what Joseph dictated, which was 269,320 words. Now, there's some restrictions if you want to emulate Joseph Smith. Okay? Restriction number one is that as you're dictating, you cannot resequence a single sentence or text block. Not a single one. The way that the printer's manuscript and what we have of the original manuscript, the way those sentences came from Joseph to Oliver's pen, were none of the sentences were rearranged. And there were some long sentences. The original Book of Mormon was a stream of words that had to be typeset by John Gilbert, who did the typesetting for the printer. But we notice here that the Book of Mormon average sentence length is 42 words, which is curious. If he's dictating 20 to 30 word blocks, he's dictating partial sentences every time. And he's not reading back. I mean, they will read back. One of the accounts says he's reading it back to make sure it's accurate, but he's not going before that. So he's dictating partial sentences on average. Now, he also dictated without punctuation. And BYU professor Roger Terry observed that that doesn't make it easier. He said Joseph Smith's task stretches far beyond his ability to convert pre-language concepts into lengthy and layered sentences. Sentence structure of the Book of Mormon, without the guidance of punctuation to separate embedded clauses, this feat would have been mind-boggling. And the importance of commas can kind of be illustrated here. The original Book of Mormon had the 1830 has, and with semicolons, over 25,000 commas. And my wife said, and she works as a professional editor, she said she'd be charging $50 an hour to put in all those commas. But she also thinks there's probably more than is needed. But when you dictate your texts, text messages can't use any punctuation. So if you're going to embed a clause, it's got to be kept right up here. And we know that Joseph dictated in a vernacular that was not his everyday speech. The Book of Mormon is not written in upstate New York language of the 1820s. It's in an early version of the King James, like the King James Bible, not identical, we're told. But you're dictating not in your everyday speech. So if you want to emulate Joseph, figure out what you want to do. It could be early English. It could be, I don't know, pick a dialect and then stay constant in that. And then you use words that you might not always use in your average discussions. This is the earliest transcript of a letter that we have from Joseph Smith. And this is just 3 months after the Book of Mormon is published. Okay, so he's just gotten done dictating 269,000 words. 3 months later, he's writing this. He closes the letter saying, "Now may God of his infinite mercy keep and preserve us spotless until his coming, and receive us all to rest with him in eternal repose through the atonement of Christ our Lord." It's interesting, the word repose does not appear in the Book of Mormon. The word rest does over 100 times. The word peace does over 100 times. But Joseph is using a word that he'd never used in the Book of Mormon dictation, but he's using it just months later in this letter. Another example, this is the earliest handwriting of the letter that we have from Joseph. He's writing from Kirtland to Hiram, who's the recipient. This is a year after the Book of Mormon was published. But Joseph said, "I have been engaged in regulating the churches here as the disciples are numerous and the devil had made many attempts to overthrow them. It has been a serious job, but the Lord is with us and we have overcome and have all things regular." Again, looking at the word choices that Joseph is making, the word job does not appear in the Book of Mormon. Serious job, nothing like that. Word all things are found in the Book of Mormon many times, but they are never regular. So again, Joseph dictated the Book of Mormon, I would argue, in a vernacular that is very different from his everyday speech. And that is what we would need to do as we emulate what he did using our cell phones. Now, this is homage to Hugh Nibley. You can make one spelling or grammar change in the recorded text every 69 words. You can make a more substantial change, but less than 5 words every 18,000 words. And we know this because Joseph made some changes in the 1837 and 1840 printings. You have to include on average 2 references to new geographical locations and 6 references to geographic movements daily, create 3 new proper names and refer to 2 individuals with biblical names daily, include 6 chiasms of between 2 and 11 levels daily. So we find out these are the requirements if we want to emulate it. Now, I present this and I've debated, but I it's in here. I don't mean for this to be in any way snarky or disrespectful, but for those who are proponents of this theory, somebody will say Joseph could produce the Book of Mormon naturally. And I hear that all the time and I get that. And then everybody seems to agree, but I think there is an elephant in the room that nobody seems to date to want to address. What is it? Well, it's simply the difficulty of creative dictation. And I'm hopeful that this presentation, which is not final in any way, will just be able to promote the discussion of how somebody mentally could create all those sentences as Joseph Smith, according to the historical record, did. Now, the intellect theory allows us to compare Joseph as an author to other authors, because Joseph Smith created the Book of Mormon just like other authors created their books. And this is a busy slide, I apologize, but what I've done is I have gathered together all authors that I could find to write a book of over 50,000 words and have it published before they're age 24. Joseph wrote it at 23, but he's 24 when the Book of Mormon was published. If we rearrange this data, it's interesting that the Book of Mormon is 50% longer than the next longest book. It's interesting that if we look at the difficulty of the text, and a lot of them don't have a number, so this isn't as helpful. But again, the Book of Mormon is more complex than any of these other books. And then if we look at the education of the people writing these books, even though they're young, all of them have more education than Joseph, except perhaps Mary Shelley. We're not sure with that. If we stack them chronologically, we find that there had only been three young authors before Joseph. And if we look at the word counts, we see those books were much shorter and not as complex. Looking at Joseph as an author, we find that his word count peaked very early, which is kind of curious. And then it tapers down. The second blip is the Joseph Smith translation, and then you see Book of Moses and Book of Abraham later. If we compare him to Tolkien, and lots of people like to do that, we see that Joseph, you know, peaked early, and Tolkien wrote his book very late in life, and he'd already done The Hobbit and everything, so he had a lot more experience. Sometimes Joseph is compared to Shakespeare, and if we look at their word outputs, Shakespeare was very constant, one or two plays every year except for 1 year. But we also notice that by the age that Shakespeare has produced his very first play, and he was well educated for that time and place, Joseph Smith had finished 85% of all the word production he was going to do. I had to compare Joseph to J.K. Rowling because I love those movies. Again, we see her starting later, crescendo a little bit, and continue. So I'll be honest with you, as I look at these five theories, and there can be more, and that's part of where I think we are with this, I don't find any of these to be very plausible based on my 4 years of research. But again, it's an ongoing process. I do want to say just a couple of things in closing. I'm not trying to prove the Book of Mormon is historical or true. I've been accused of that. We do not prove supernatural phenomena through natural evidences. Okay? You just can't do that. Secondly, it's not a God of the gaps argument. I'm not saying, well, we can't figure out how Joseph did it, so God must be there. Okay, that's not it. We can't end with that. That's not the. But here's the take home. If Joseph Smith produced the Book of Mormon naturally, the process ought to be understandable and repeatable. And so that's my hope, is that we can just look harder, not at the input, not at the output so much, but just let's talk about creative dictation, talk about what these theories actually are saying about the creation of the words. I do have this article coming out in BYU Studies, next issue. And it goes over some of the same material. If you're interested, it will be available online. I just talked to Steve Harper this last week, and he said, yeah, we'll make it available online. So that'll be on my Facebook page, and it's a general page if you go there. If you're interested for a link, as soon as it's uploaded, I'll make that available. Thank you very much. Do we have questions?
Ryan, that was really good. So you and the church have both acknowledged Joseph with the seer stone and the hat theory. You had that picture up on your presentation, so I'm assuming that you accept the seer stone and the hat theory.
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. That's what documented.
So there's been some progress on that regard. So I just picked up Michael Markart's, one of his pamphlets, Changing Revelatory Messages. So this is, I'm just going to quote, he quotes Brant Gardner in his book, The Gift and Power. You're probably familiar with that. And this is just a quote from Brant. It says, "The number of testimonies about the face and the hat method indicate that even if the plates were nearby, Joseph was not consulting them during the translation." So two questions arise from that quote. First of all, were there actual gold plates? First question.
Okay, want me to respond now?
Yes or no on that one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely. Why? Why do we need gold plates if they were unnecessary for the translation process?
It's a really, really good question, because I don't think Joseph Smith had any idea, as he's dictating the words to Oliver Cowdery and the other scribes, I don't think he had any clue whether what he was saying through Revelation was how it related to what was engraven on the plates. Okay, to me, the plates were the beginning, but something has transformed those words through Revelation. And we can only speculate because we don't know, but the message Joseph Smith was given, and we ought to think of the Book of Mormon not as a translation, but as a revelation, and that it had been definitely upgraded. And last year I presented at the Joseph Smith Papers Project conference, and my topic was Book of Mormon theories, translation theories. I gave 6 reasons to believe Joseph was not reading from the seer stone, and I gave 2 really good reasons to believe that he was. And we just can't know what's happening. But at the end of this discussion, I left I had 3 quotes, one from Grant Hardy, one from Royal Skousen, and one from Richard Bushman. They all said that between what was on the plates and what Joseph Smith was seeking, there was a transition. There was an interim translator, somebody who's able to use the King James Bible, if you will, because there's so much intertextuality with the King James Bible. And for decades, that has been used as an evidence that this must have come from Joseph Smith. And not only that, the 19th century elements are all through the Book of Mormon, and you would not have expected those to be on the plates. How did they get there? And of course, the critic is saying, well, it just came from Joseph Smith. But as we've just observed, what we've done is we've taken a difficult dictation that Joseph Smith made, and then we discover the 19th century elements and intertextuality with the Bible that's interwoven into this text, and he's just dictating it one sentence after another. We've elevated the level of complexity of that dictation. And even though there are some secularists that will say this is evidence Joseph had to have done it, I'm saying no. It's evidence Joseph could not have done it. 23-year-old farmer, to be able to integrate that stuff, and Grant Hardy and Nick Fredericks, they're talking about this intertextuality, the similarities to the Bible. How does somebody do that off the top of their head in real time? I think it increases the difficulty of the dictation. And for me, we don't know how. I mean, what you're asking questions we don't have answers to exactly. But the book that was written was definitely transformed when Joseph Smith was speaking it, is my opinion.
Brian, I'd like to thank you for your very fine delineation of various possibilities, and I'd like to take a dialogical approach to it rather than a dialectical approach, i.e. it's not this or that, but it could be a combination of a number of these things operating. And I am working right now on an aspect of the creation of the Book of Mormon that is looked at from the perspective of chaos theory. Spontaneous self-organization of ideas, themes, characters in the mind is a part of what goes on as the author engages in writing. And I'd like to call to your attention the biography of Joseph Smith by Lucy Mack Smith, his mother. I can't exactly off the top of my head recall the exact title, but you'll find this in a few minutes of search. Something to the effect of a biography of my son Joseph the Prophet. And in this biography, she talks about how he would regale people in the evenings with stories about the ancient peoples of the Americas, their means of travel, their types of warfare, their religion, their dress, their beasts of burden, and so on and so forth, which suggests to me that the ideas that emerged in the Book of Mormon were percolating there for quite some time. We need to remember there were no media in those days of radio and television, and stories were told all the time. And one can look at the Book of Mormon from the perspective of chaos theory as a spontaneous self-organization of stories of the ancient world, ancient America, which arose in the mind of Joseph Smith. Now, I was thinking about this for an article I was writing, and it drove me crazy because I could not find the word stories in Lucy Mack's biography of Joseph Smith. With a word search, it was recitals.
Yes.
And when I found that, I was so happy I had it, the quote I needed. But I do think that chaos, spontaneous self-organization of ideas from his culture and his milieu could be a part of the various methods of creation.
No. Excellent point. Let me respond, though, and let me challenge you as you put this together. any author, as they're writing, is asking and answering two questions all the time. What do I want to say? How do I want to say it? And the recitals could have answered that first question. He could have had this outline in his head and everything. The real difficulty of creative dictation is answering the second question. How do I want to say it? That's wordsmithing. That's syntax. That's lexical choices. That's maintaining coherency, sentence to sentence, yesterday's sentences. That is something I don't think chaos can support. And that's what we need an explanation for with respect to how Joseph did it. That's the heavy lifting of the translation, and nobody's talking about it. How do I want to say it? I don't think you can base that on chaos.
I would just beg to point out that I spoke about a dialogical approach, not chaos alone.
Right. But implement
part,
that.
But as know, a part
the
of
wordsmithing,
the whole process.
The wordsmithing is the hard part of explaining what Joseph did. Because even though there are critics and there are 3,913 changes in the Book of Mormon, just pick up an 1830 Book of Mormon and start reading it. It's very coherent. It's very complex. And Joseph did it in one take. And that's the core question in my mind that needs answering.
Well,
just include that.
Yeah,
in your theory.
I there is the country bumpkin, school of thought about Joseph Smith. He didn't know anything. He wasn't educated. He could not have done this. You could also look at him as a genius with extraordinary capabilities, and then that would fill in some of that gap. But thank you so much.
Well, and just on that, we don't find him being a genius after that. You saw the word count and everything. So document his genius after the Book of Mormon is done. It's hard to do, but. That would
the Book of Mormon is a work of genius.
There you go. I think I would agree.
I don't agree with that. But anyway, that's beyond the point. My question is, and I know that everybody probably knows this and I don't know this, but when Joseph Smith was dictating the Book of Mormon, do we know that he didn't have additional sources with him? Because it's my understanding that sometimes he was in the next room and the transcriber was not actually right there and couldn't see him. So do we know that he never had other, because I really liked your flow chart, figuring out the creative dictation. I really get that. But I was wondering, it wasn't all done with one, like wasn't there some time where he may have had an additional source?
Yeah, and that's common. People will kind of assume things are there that the historical record really doesn't allow for. Joseph did use a curtain when he was transcribing characters to give to Martin to take up to New York. There was a curtain there. Beyond that, there was never a curtain. The scribe was looking. Dan, am I right here? Yeah. There was always, they were watching. And we've got unbelievers and believers all agreeing. He's looking in a hat with a seer stone and speaking the word. And so, and I've had big arguments online. Was Joseph looking into a Bible for 2 days, reciting the Isaiah chapters? And there's just no supportive evidence. And we have two comments from David Whitmer, two comments from Emma Smith saying there were no notes or books or anything. So, what's that? Dan and I have gone back and forth on this, too, so hear his part.
The statements we have from David Whitmer and Emma Smith saying that he used the hat and that there were no other manuscripts around, they were responding to the Spalding theory. So if he used a Bible, they wouldn't have included that as a source because the Bible is in the Book of Mormon. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, and in response to that, actually, Emma said there was no other source of information. He couldn't have hidden it from me. It does exclude the Book of Mormon, but they do respond to manuscripts. I have to be careful because he really knows this stuff. So, say that again, Dan.
So the reason why we know that he's not behind the curtain, besides copying the characters, is that Emma gave her testimony that he had the head in the hat. Mark Harris gave his testimony that Joseph had the head in the hat, and David Whitmer. Martin Harris and Emma were scribes for the last 116 pages, and that's their testimony.
Yeah, I've collected the four quotes. Just look at what they say. They're pretty exclusive. But Dan is right. They were responding to claims of the Spalding manuscript being present. But the verbiage in at least a couple of them is inclusive of any book, I would argue. But again, this will go on and on, I'm sure. So, yeah. We just got 5 minutes, so hopefully we can get this done.
I have a few things. I wanted to thank you. I appreciate you admitting your bias. I myself have no investment in proving Joseph Smith was a prophet, so I feel like that gives me a certain advantage. I, too, am a professional editor and a teacher of writing, among other things. One thing, comparing books, the Book of Mormon, to other books, they may be shorter, but I would argue they're better written. In my opinion, the Book of Mormon doesn't qualify as literature. It may qualify as a religious text and revelation, but I don't think it would rank very high for an objective measure of literature. And when you say complexity, I certainly would hope it's not just measured by sentence length. There's other measures of complexity. But I think what I really feel morally obligated to say whenever these kind of discussions have is this uneducated country bumpkin thing. And I have to talk about Lincoln, who was born approximately the same time as Joseph Smith, he's a little bit younger, and who was self-educated, became a lawyer and perhaps our best president. He had intermittent education that they think maybe adds up to 12 months total formal education. So it only seems fair to put Joseph Smith's education in a context. It seems really unfair to me to not do that.
If people want to believe he was smart enough to do the dictation, I mean, what can we say? That's just a personal opinion. We have to respect that. So.
Thank you for your presentation. I thought it was really compelling. And I'm open to the idea that the God, the Holy Ghost, whatever, was influencing his translation process. But you did acknowledge the intertextuality between 19th century texts and culture. And so my question is, do you think the Book of Mormon is, would you view it as a literal history of Lamanites and Nephites, or would you just say that it's an inspired text of the time, like wisdom literature? What do you think it is?
You know, that's a real common approach by even some church members will say, I don't think it's historical, but I like it and I'm going with it. Personally, and that's okay. If you can muster faith, even with that as your foundation, go with it. I wouldn't want to say anything against that. Personally, I think it's very historical, but I also think it was retranslated before Joseph got it. And I think lots of things were added in, and that the text we have has been customized for our day to help us with the issues that we have, but also to convey through the Spirit the ability to know God is there. And so I wouldn't say that it's literally what was on the plate. So,
thanks for your presentation, Brian. So I have one request and one question. So I'm an active, faithful LDS who believes the Book of Mormon is not historical and that it came largely through the mind of Joseph Smith, also as a revelation in a supernatural process. I don't think we would talk about President Nelson's revelation as being secular or being through his own intellect, right? We would say it came through his mind, but that there was also God involved. So I think we can be creative if we have an assumption that God is involved. We can be creative with a lot of different models. You know, he could have spent 6 years working on this in his mind, and then when he's in the seer stone, that's his moment to be locked in with God. And so he's kind of dictating, he's saying what he's been thinking about, but it comes through God as well. God's maybe fixing his words to make sure nothing stupid comes out, you know. And then my question, what do you think about DNC 9, study it out in terms of the Book of Mormon translation process. How does that work?
The question is, study it out. What is the antecedent of it? And we honestly don't know. Joseph, when he was doing the Book of Abraham, was trying to study the hieroglyphics. And so he's working on that. He spent some time studying the Reformed Egyptian, the characters that he had out there. I'm not sure we know exactly what that was. And I don't think we know exactly what Oliver had not studied sufficiently to be able to translate. To me, there's several interpretations. I actually talked about one of them in my presentation, but I'm not sure we know for sure exactly what it is. Do we study the Reformed Egyptian? Does he study how to translate? Does he study God's will? Does he want me to translate? These are some of the ideas that have been promoted. So this better be our last question, I think. And I've got to go to late. I'm presenting another one. That's why the suit, okay? I know we don't do suits at Sunstone. I do know that, but I'll be jetting out of here, so.
So just a quick question, sort of a comparative religious sort of thing. Would you apply equal consideration to, say, Muhammad and the Quran? It was received, you know, in one go. There was an angel that was involved. You know, followers talk about its beauty and its complexity. And just so we're clear, I'm not a Muslim. But I was just wondering if you would grant another argument that's made is that the Book of Mormon was dictated in very low-tech times. The Quran was dictated in even lower-tech times. So I was just wondering if you would grant equal weight to that, consider it to be inspired, word of God, that kind of thing.
The Quran is about 77,000 words, so the Book of Mormon is almost four times longer, so it's a bigger deal. But I think our general, and the Book of Mormon says, if it's good, it's from God. If it isn't, it's not. And Joseph would respond to other works as saying that it's from God, it's from man, it's from a false spirit. I'm not going to even begin to touch where we think all of the words come from, except to say things that bring about good are going to have come from God. Okay. I'm sorry, I can't be more specific, but that's probably the best. But thank you all for coming. Sure appreciate it.